Hello and welcome to another great episode of Intercom on Product, your go-to podcast for the latest insights and ideas in product management, design and strategy, directly from the product leaders building Intercom. In today's episode, we're diving into the emerging world of AI product management. Julia Godinho, one of our senior product managers, recently wrote a thought-provoking blog post on the subject. Julia discusses the topic with Brian Donahue, Intercom's VP of Product, sharing her key lessons after a year of building AI-driven products at Intercom. The future of how we build technology is going to look very different from today, and the art and science of product management is undergoing rapid change. There's so much to learn from today's conversation. For those who prefer not just to listen, but to read and watch, you can find Julia's blog post on the Intercom blog or catch this episode on YouTube. All the links are in our show notes. If you find Intercom on Product as valuable as we hope, we'd be delighted if you could leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. Your feedback means the world to us. Also, feel free to share this episode on LinkedIn, Twitter, or your preferred social platform to help us spread the word. Additionally, keep up to date with our latest product content by subscribing to the Intercom on Product monthly newsletter at inter.com/product newsletter. Find the link in our show notes. Now, let's get into the heart of AI and product management with Julia and Brian.
Welcome to the podcast, Julia. Good to have you here.
Hello. Thank you very much. I'm excited to be here talking to you, Brian.
Okay, so let's talk about what it's like being a PM in the world of building AI products. Lots of juicy stuff to dig into here. So maybe what's useful to start out is just give a bit of a sense of kind of your experience working on AI projects. What type, how many, how long, you know, how wide, how deep, that sort of stuff.
So since joining Intercom, I've been in the automation group where I focused on building automation for the self-serve support use case. And this included working on what we called Resolution Bot, which is our AI chatbot Finn's predecessor, and Resolution Bot essentially worked through neural networks that detected topics and matched answers. And then I've been working on Finn since the early beta, since it came out, and then involved in the general access launch and working on the subsequent releases since then. Most recently, the team's been working on things such as making Finn multilingual and on a reporting and insights piece that have surfaced unresolved questions to give customers insights into the gaps in their content or chatbot setup. But actually, prior to working at Intercom, I've also worked on other AI projects in a couple of different industries. I worked on an app, a private members club app, where I developed a product to connect members with similar interests based on behavioral data. And that specifically used unsupervised learning for the clustering technique, and also worked for a leading e-commerce here in the UK on recommender systems to help customers find the perfect gift for their card, as well as other things such as like promotion engines to determine on a customer level what's the level of discount that would encourage repeat purchases. So quite a different mix of ML AI product experience.
Nice. So, and a lot of old world AI tech before you could really call it AI, we'd call it ML tech back then. And now everyone's comfortable calling it AI tech. So old world and new world stuff as well. So let's start on. So you wrote a blog post on this, like reflecting on what you've learned as a PM working on this stuff. And one topic you pulled out was curiosity. Curiosity has always been a thing of, hey, all PMs need to be curious. Everyone wants to make sure they say they're curious at interviews, all that sort of stuff there. Is there anything that's different here of the importance of curiosity for AI, or is it just the same thing extended into this new world?
Yeah, I don't really think so, to be honest. I think like being curious and inquisitive in general just unlocks new knowledge, which in turn opens up all these different possibilities when it comes to thinking about problems and solutions. So I think it's a great trait for a product manager or anyone in general for that matter. I think what's changed in the last year or so perhaps is maybe the pace of learning, in specific, like the constant flurry of new information, especially regarding generative AI, you know, whether that's about new products being developed or foundational models being built or updated, use cases that are being unlocked, or just like wider industry changes, you know, such as the race to produce chips, for example, all of these things, just like it comes all at once. I feel like it can be quite overwhelming at times. So I think the ability to just pick what you consume and when is important, but it's an exciting time to be a product manager. There's so many things to learn, so many, you know, dots to join. So I think that sort of underlying curiosity will benefit anyone really.
Yeah, it makes sense. I think the other thing reflecting on it is it's critical that the curiosity is not just reading reading is like the, I can't say it's the least valuable because it's so critical. It has to come from using or watching people use it. And using it enough so you can almost observe yourself. Like, for example, one thing I found that was interesting, like just using ChatGPT, the mobile app, is I just started saying, I'm going to actually start recording voice stuff here. And if there was no logical, I just started doing it. And then afterwards, I was like, huh, why am I doing that more? And it's because, hey, I know I can be wordy with these bots. It's actually better to give them more information. And I'm too slow to type. When you type, you just want to cut to the chase on your phone. But, you know, when we talk, doing what I'm doing now, talking too much, too long, right? And but that's actually better for the new world. You know, maybe that's like, because you kind of know the tech a little more, you do that. But anyway, so I think these are the thing that's interesting, is that you have to see how your behavior is adapting. And then also, like, another thing that was interesting was Jordan and I on the plane yesterday, and just reading snippets of from our own support team using some of the stuff we're building. And you just see little microcosms. And we had, just on seeing one little example of a customer, of one of our own support team asking a question, and it just unlocked all this. Oh, that's a different use case. Oh, it's just the dots start connecting. So I think the curiosity, it's critical that it's grounded in people actually using the tech now, not grounded in seeing secondhand stuff or reading stuff in there. Of course, that's part of it. But, you know, because that's the shit. There's all these nuances of change that happen that are quite meaningful with how this tech does it. But you got to get into the actual usage of it. So cool. Another thing you mentioned here was, you know, everyone is in a rush to try to integrate AI, or almost everyone in a rush to integrate AI. And you're kind of anchoring towards, hey, you still got to have this problem solving focus. So we actually talked about this our PM onsite last week. Like, how do you think, you know, at Intercom, we've got a principle that almost everyone building product have some version of start with the problem, right? Really, the test is, do you do it, not do you say it? So you think working with AI projects has an impact on that principle? Like, does it change how we should think about it or do it?
Yeah, I think definitely impacts it. Yeah, I mean, like, as you mentioned, I've seen sort of several instances where product folk have been encouraged to just drop work that they're doing and figure out how they can just incorporate AI into the product, or where they're being rewarded for just adding AI into the mix. And I guess while I assume good intent and believe it's a worthwhile like exercise to think about how the use of AI can make your product significantly better, I think there's a danger in sort of just this indiscriminate use of like just add AI and mix approach. And I think that's the reason, because you're not really thinking about it from first principles, really looking to better understand sort of the underlying problem and starting from there. I think, you know, the meaning behind our principle, you know, start with a problem, is that at the beginning of the initiative, we seek to really understand, deeply understand the problem that we're looking to solve, framing that problem clearly, having a really good rationale, you know, as to why, like what the problem is, why it's a worthwhile problem to solve, and how we'll know if we've solved it. So I think when working on AI projects, I think that problem first mentality is still required to ensure that we're actually solving an important problem. And then once you've identified the problem, then you can, you know, ask yourself whether AI would make that solution 10, 100 times better. It could actually be that it doesn't actually make the solution significantly better, right? Or the risks or costs don't actually outweigh the benefits. So I think that's why it's so important to start with the problem first, so you've got that North Star to help you make those decisions. But I would say that I think in terms of like how it's changed our approach to principles, I would say that there's times where we've been more fluid in our approach into as to how we start. I think this is especially true when, for example, there's a new advancement in the underlying technology, an update to model, for example, where, you know, the ML engineers will first start with an exploration to understand what is possible with that technology. And then once you've determined like the feasibility and the viability, then we'll more proactively join up the dots with the problems that we're trying to solve and understand like how they can work together. But I think the important thing here was, when you're taking this different approach, is that you frequently come back to inspect the problem that you initially defined to make sure that it still makes sense, you're still on the right track. So it has changed it a bit, but I think fundamentally we're still, you know, starting with a problem, having that problem first mindset. What do you think?
Yeah, I think the second part of it, I would say, I think it's more of a change, and I think this existed. I think actually the like what we talked about last week, the verb start is wrong. Sometimes you start with the problem, but a lot of times you don't. And that's okay and sometimes good. And I think AI is where often you're actually starting with a possibility. Hey, is this this could be freaking cool. Is this just cool peripheral sprinkle pixie fairy dust around this? Or is this actually valuable? But first, is it plausible? And I think frequently you start with the opportunities. And I think the risk is you get so excited about the opportunities, standard stuff, right? You forget to, but you still have to anchor it in a problem worth solving. And I think this is where the people who understand the problems are the ones most likely to figure out which are the most valuable opportunities, as opposed to the ones who go after the opportunity and go after it and say, well, yeah, no one really cared about that. So I think that, and I think a couple tangible examples here, but I think it exacerbates, it makes it riskier. Because you can just go after, we know it's vaguely a problem, go after it. Like, you know, remember last week, we have a big project now. And the PM was saying, I actually have not written an intermission. I have not written down the problem statement here. And because it felt like everyone knows it and you're moving fast and you're so much, will it work? Will it work? And then you validate if it's valuable. So I think it is more tempting. And so I think like that, what we were talking about last week is our principle needs to change from start with the problem to no, sweat the problem. You need to come back. You need to be sure you can actually articulate it. You're actually scoping out the solution for the problems that scope the problem statement and all that sort of stuff there. Because I think it is not just more tempting, but almost recommended. Because like you mentioned one thing, start with the problem. Then you say, can AI help us with this? I bet that's less what's happening. I bet generally it's more opportunity driven is where I think the state of what everyone's looking for. Where is that? There's this new tech. It has opened up a whole new world. There's opportunities everywhere. Which ones are most valuable? So it's like, there's an opportunity. Can do it. Can we ground it? But I think, you know, you mentioned, talked about the example framing, like that feasibility part where your spreadsheet, you know, frame that example here. I think that's a great example of like, to validate the feasibility, you kind of need to not wildly change approaches, but definitely change from where it was before. Share that answer. I think that one's interesting.
Yeah, for sure. That was actually part of the work that I mentioned at the beginning in the intro, where we were working on this reporting and insights piece. And just fundamentally with a product like that, that generates data, you want to make sure that the data that is being produced actually solves a problem that this customer is, you know, your customers are looking for. So before we even started thinking about the experience, like the customer experience, we wanted to validate whether the data that we would produce would actually be of value. And that's, we did it in the most scrappy way possible. We just generated the data, stuck it into a spreadsheet and put it in front of customers and said, you know, just open-ended questions like, what would you do with this data? Like, what's the next step? How does this help you? Just to really tease out like what that data would enable them to do. And then we joined the dots with our own, you know, learning plan. Like, does it do what it needs to do? Really, does it solve that problem and help them? In this case, identify the gaps in their content and know where they can improve. So it's just something that you can start out really scrappy with just a spreadsheet and just validate that before putting too much effort into shaping the solution without knowing if it actually produces anything good.
And what's also interesting as you're talking through that is, and sometimes the reason to go faster over is because we've already been in this problem space before. We just can do it better now because there was a version of Resolution Bot, of unanswered questions of Resolution Bot, right? And that was the old tech. So it was okay, sometimes useful, sometimes not. And the new tech is magnitudes better than the old one in the quality of that, right? So I think that's also a temptation, but also there's permission to, hey, we know this space. We know this problem. We can just now solve it better than we ever could before. I don't think we wrote in a problem statement for Finn. It's just like the same thing we've been working on. It's now three times better. And the opportunity is you don't have to write, curate each question. So it's funny, like talking through it, it's like acknowledging the temptation to skip over it is way greater than it is normally with AI. Maybe occasionally that's justified, but recognize it's like danger here where you do that because you normally need to sweat the problem there in some place. And make just curious to tie, like, hey, that tangible example of the unanswered questions, did that start with the opportunity or that actually started with, hey, our customers are saying they need us to do this. What's the best way to do that? What was the actual origin of that project?
Yeah, the latter. Like we did a lot of research to understand how our customers were using the chatbot. What were the opportunities? What were the pain points? We just started with like, you know, pure research as we would normally do anyway. This was one of the big themes that were coming up in terms of like, hey, I want to know what else I can do to get the most out of the chatbot, or the best results out of the chatbot. And that's sort of when we started to like dig deeper into that and understand like what customers actually mean with that. Of course, there were plenty of ways that we could solve that, but we thought, you know, we did this initial, then sort of went into doing like the, you know, the viability, the feasibility explorations to say, OK, hey, like, what can we do? Like, does the technology that we have enable us to do something that's significantly better? And as you mentioned, we already had another version of this product, but we knew all the pitfalls of the approach of the old technology or the product that we had. And we thought that we could take a good bet with doing this in a different way, sort of starting, but again, starting from first principles, really.
It's interesting because I think there's almost like three buckets of it. Like bucket one is like opportunity driven one. And that's what the first stuff we released, you know, over a year ago was opportunity driven. Where can we do something fast that's valuable here? And then, hey, is this a problem or not? And then where you're saying it's like, no, it's problem driven, but we look to see, is AI going to be the best solution for it? I think the third bucket is different, is like AI is not part of it. It's not part of the solution that you're doing, but you actually need to ask yourself, what's the durability of this solution? Is this a threat of like, we're basically building old technology today? And that's like the hardest to know. And well, first you got to say, hey, is this problem durable? And you got to, so it's funny thinking about it, of like, I can't think of the right way to frame it, but it's like, you also got to sense check the non-AI product you're building and ask yourself, what's the shelf life of this? Which no one freaking knows the answer to, but you kind of need to do it. And it's like, problem might not be durable. AI might make the problem go away. Or no, we think the problem's durable, but this solution, this solution has a short shelf life, and maybe we still need to do it. Or it's like an example is help centers, and we've done a bunch of work on our help center, and customers still want more and more. And it's like, well, I don't know, how long are help centers going to be the way customers are actually going to find their answers? That feels like a risky space to keep investing in, because the problem might go away, because it becomes less important. So that's, even if it's the problem itself that becomes, what's the word, irrelevant. That's like the fear. Every PM needs to live and actually actively force himself to live with the fear of, is what you're working on, what is the time frame, and what you're working on will be irrelevant, which is unanswerable, but you still got to ask yourself that. Let's go on to the next topic here, Julia. This one is interesting. Attitudes towards AI. Like, I think I'm trying to think of like, where has like even the old world of ML, there were attitudes. Hey, how are customers comfortable dealing with uncertainty? But broadly, it's like, this is a new world for PMs to be considering, is like the psychology of the people toward their viewpoint towards the technology is coming in. So tell us your experience of this. How has this impacted what you've been working on?
Yeah, so people's or our customers' perceptions towards using AI. I think the way that I like to look at it is sort of how it's laid out in Crossing the Chasm, right? You've got the people who want the newest thing and are willing to try it out as soon as possible, warts and all, regardless of like whether it fully works or not. And those are, you know, your innovators, early adopters. And then you've got those who want the complete experience. They'll wait until the product is stable to be able to adopt it. And this sort of variance we've seen within our own customer base, their perceptions vary towards AI in a wild manner. They can, like, on the complete opposite spectrum. You know, when we first launched Finn, we saw an influx of people who were very bullish about the use of AI and willing to try it out as soon as possible. You know, these people have the advantage of better understanding where the technology is at and what is possible with it. They also develop a quick understanding of what they need to do to get the outcomes that they want. However, there are people that are naturally more hesitant. They want to first understand what is possible, how they can properly prepare for AI products before actually committing to it. And that's usually because they have processes and that they, you know, need to adhere to, or the cost of switching is significant to a point where they need to really properly consider the implications. So I think it's important when we're doing our work to understand the different levels of knowledge or understanding that your customers have of AI, so that you can cater to that. I think, you know, ideally you should be making products so easy to understand and to use to the point where how it works on the hood doesn't really matter, and anyone can clearly articulate the benefit of the product and just get started with it. But I think in this current climate where, you know, this new technology, talking about generative AI, is so at the forefront of our minds, customers build their own expectations of what it can do and how it should work and how it can work. So I think that's quite different to, you know, what we talk about, the old technology where we had ML powered products, but the expectations weren't as heightened. So I think in terms of how we approach this, there's sort of like two things I think is important. You've got, first is, you know, building a bridge between the now and sort of the future, or like what we envision the future to be. I think Des recently talked about this in another podcast where he mentioned our approach to rolling out sort of lower risk AI capabilities in, on the agent side before launching the chatbot. And the reason that we did that was to help customers build familiarity with the technology and gain confidence in how it can produce value for them. But then on the other side, there's also the customer education piece, where I think it becomes increasingly important to set expectations on what won't and will work, and so that they can better understand what they can actually expect out of the product. So it's been really interesting to like navigate these completely, you know, opposing views from the same sort of customer base as well. I think you've probably seen similar things, right, in the feedback that you've got from customers.
Yeah, like the gamut is broad, you know, from people who are building, hey, they're like, hey, let me show you what I've built, and I'm integrated in Intercom. Like, we literally just had someone yesterday showing off something they've built, and they're like, hey, maybe you guys should roll this out. Maybe this should be an app here of like, you know, people hands-on, understand how the technology works, trying to make it, trying to do their own versions of things. We've seen several people building this from, so you've got people who are genuinely on the edge of building their own technology here. I'll read out a quote that we had in our product survey. Here's like, one is like, please get rid of AI. It's absolutely pointless in this case. I don't know what this case is referencing, but it was a customer support. It's like, whoa, okay. And then here's a harsher one that we've heard. This is a quote, the integration of AI into Intercom has turned me from a huge Intercom fan and advocate into someone who would switch from Intercom tomorrow if I had the time. It's like, oh, gut punch. Like, so there are strong opinions out there. So one is you just have, there's a camp of people who are just like, AI is bad for the world, for humanity. You got this part of stuff coming in. But then you also get the softer stuff, because we also have a lot of people, we know broadly people are actually quite receptive to the idea of AI is going to be good for customer support. Let's figure out in the detail. I don't know how the details are going to work. And people don't understand the technology, and it's blurry because every company out there is saying they've got all AI and all AI this, and deliberately trying to blur what's genuinely new tech from what's not, was never really AI. And you know, so a lot of companies are trying to blur it, but customers, it's hard for them to read through all of that. So I think you have kind of depth of understanding, wide variability, actual view towards is AI a good thing or bad thing? And obviously there's meaty, valuable conversations of that, and just hesitance and reluctance. And I think one thing that existed before is customers dealing with uncertainty of product. And, you know, the old world, even ResolutionBot the ML was match. You'd kind of train it on 20 examples, but there was still softness. The ML was actually trying to use natural language to match that. And now that uncertainty is like exponential, because you never, and in the old world, you'd actually say what the bot would say, try to match this question and then say this. In the new world, you never know what exactly Finn's going to say, and it's not going to have it. I remember with ML or multilingual, when you were showing that, it's like, before we put on the constraints and gave our customers control of it, it's like, if you ask in French, Finn might reply in French, Finn might not. Finn might reply in French and then give it, like, it is unpredictable how the thing will work. So the level of unpredictability of the product is itself a leap for customers to get comfortable with. And some customers embrace it, and they're like, I know, I get it. We're just in this new world. You get such huge upside, and there's unpredictability as part of that. And for other people, that unpredictability is a huge leap, and they're way less comfortable with it. So that's like a different angle. I'm against AI. I'm just uncomfortable with the product. I don't know exactly what that experience is going to be for my customers. People, like, ultimately, it's like, people want control of a product that's going to their customers, which makes sense. And AI removes, to some extent, that control. So that's like another huge challenge. That's like and these are major product challenges, you know, like, because you're actually having to build products to try to get people confident with the thing there. You know, so I think the attitudes towards AI is a whole new level. It's kind of like, we rarely had to think about pricing. Like, can we actually make this thing feasible cost-wise? That's now a thing. We actually didn't talk about that, but that's a new thing that everyone needs to think about with AI. Attitudes are AI. That's probably a new thing to think about here. So yeah, there are a bunch of new angles here. All right, we'll keep going. Let's go with the tech side here. There's a hypothesis that seems valid, which is like, hey, the new world, you better be a pretty damn tech-savvy PM. Otherwise, you ain't really going to be worth your salt. That's probably not the phrase, but whatever the phrase is, you're going to be no damn good.
Something like that.
Something like that. So what's your sense of this? Well, actually, I'll start like, hey, be blunt. Do you understand how LLMs work? How, like, do you get this or no? How technically savvy do you consider yourself here? And imagine I'm Fergal and I'm asking you that question. What would you say?
Well, to Fergal, definitely. No, I know nothing. I think this is like the maybe one of those age-old questions in product, right? Like, how technical should a PM be? I think it's important to have a broader understanding of what the technology enables you to do and a high level of how it works, you know, from an architecture perspective, for example, right? You need to know your product and how it works. I think this helps you have a better conversations with your team, ask the right questions, challenge assumptions. I think, you know, broadly understanding the benefits of different models will also help you have more productive conversations or discussions and make decision-making more effective. So, you know, for chatbot, for example, there are a lot of variables that you might need to consider, for example, like cost that we talked about, latency, rate of hallucinations. But I don't think necessarily that PMs need to be writing code, for example. I think the value of the PM really is to bring a customer lens to the discussion and make sure we're always coming back to what a particular decision means for the person using the product. So for me, that means, you know, encouraging a discussion about how a decision that we're going to make now will impact both our customers using the Intercom product, but also the end user interacting with the Intercom messenger, for example. So I think there's all these different levels of discussions in the day-to-day that you're having with your, you know, with the engineers, with the ML researchers, scientists, that is always helpful to bring that customer user lens to. I think you'll definitely not understand all the ins and outs of how the, you know, these new models, LLMs work, but it, you know, having a broad sense of what it enables is really helpful to start those discussions and sort of like tease things out a little bit more. I think that's my opinion on it, but maybe I'm biased. What do you think?
Well, I'll go back like 10 years ago, and I remember we had one of the first PMs in our group, Luke, and he actually had a PhD in computer science. I don't want to say, oh, I'm so jealous of you having technical expertise. And he's like, it's actually a hindrance. I know too much, too tempting to go in there and distracts me from where, hey, I'm less of a benefit to the team there. I need to focus on the customer side of things. So it was interesting because that's like going back 10 years ago, which was an interesting like counter Google approach to how technical PM should be. But I think the new world, like I've questioned it myself, like on my own level of technical sophistication. And I don't have a confident read of this yet, but my view is if I would fail pretty miserably at trying to describe how LLMs were built. I've read this, but I don't remember it well enough. And I remember one of the diagrams where it's like, you know, got more context of the question that's coming in. It was actually able to take in more words. There's a word for that. Can't remember the phrase.
Context window.
No, it's not that one. This is like in training and like the literal, I can't even fucking remember the technical words, like whatever the technology breakthrough for LLMs was, which I can't even remember that word.
Oh, the Transformers. Okay.
Transformer, yeah. Like what is the breakthrough technology of the Transformer? I think that's interesting, useful to read, and utterly irrelevant to the job. What you need to understand is these LLM things exist now. You don't know a damn thing unless you're working in one of the very small number of companies actually building LLMs, which is a tiny amount of companies. Everyone else is using these LLMs. You need to understand the thing that's actually given to your team. You do need to understand, as you mentioned, what is the risks of hallucinations, understand the strengths and weaknesses, understand, you know, how multilingual are they out of the box, right? That was on things we had to cover. How good are they? Pretty good, not amazing, but so like understanding the strengths and weaknesses of this tech, which everyone is still figuring out because they are so good. The tech is so good at so many things. But I think, and you mentioned this, I think what's critical and essential is every PM needs to understand how this tech is working in their system. So for example, most customers, so Intercom works by the simplest thing is, hey, feed it this knowledge base and we point Fin at that and it automatically gets answers from there. Most customers' mental model of how this works is Fin knows that whole knowledge base. And when a question comes, it's kind of answering, just like ChatGPT knows all the freaking content in the world, right? But that's not how it works. You can't give this to that training data. You don't train the LLM. And that's why there's this whole RAG system that works. And it's actually, no, it's more nuanced. There's search that goes and then extracts the part of this content, blah, 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 blah. So So summary is like, I think every PM who's working in this, who's working in a system that's using RAG, you need to understand how RAG works, why RAG is needed, and the strengths and weaknesses that presents to your product, even though your customers aren't going to understand it. So I think that that's what you need to understand, the technical architecture of the how AI is working with the product. Like another example is here is like people think, oh, we have conversation data surfaced in it. And everyone's like, oh yeah, it just automatically goes and searches all this stuff. No. We've got to use the new AI to go and actually extract this. We don't do that in real time. We do that like this sort of architecture of the system is essential for every PM to know. So I think there's like forgiveness of like, you don't need to be an AI expert in the how LLMs were created, or here's how the next LLM will be trained. Those are for the true technologists. But for the AI PM today, is you damn well better understand how AI is working within your system. And, you know, like something for me is like, and maybe it's too self-referential, but when people say, oh yeah, I'm going to train the AI, like I always cringe. I'm like, no one's training the AI. Like, anyway, it depends what you mean by that. But I think having that level of technical expertise is what people need to understand, because that's required to understand the opportunities, the constraints, and figure out how it doesn't matter if the mental models are wildly off of how people think this stuff is happening, which sometimes it's okay. So it's I imagine we'll continually iterate our view of this, and maybe in a year we'll say, no, we're wrong. We need to fucking understand how these things are created. Okay, let's see. Where were we at? Okay, we'll try to wrap up. So last one is collaboration with ML experts. Or with the ML engineers, right? Is that same or different? What's been your experience of how to think about working with the ML folk?
I think in general, building products is a team sport. And at the heart of that is collaboration. You know, you won't build a good product if you can't work well together. And that's why I think it's so important to actually put time into figuring out how you'll work together. You know, I actually used to work as an agile coach in a previous life and saw so many teams skip this step. And I think it's like a make or break situation. You know, you really should invest time in figuring this out. You know, at Intercom, we have a centralized AI group, but we work with ML experts on most of the things that we do, whether that's, you know, a new feature or an improvement to an existing one. So it's key that we're building strong relationships to make this work well. So I think no is the answer, regardless of the kind of product that you're working on or who you're working with. I think that collaboration and good collaborative ways of working are at the heart of successful products. I know you've been thinking about this for a bit. Where have you landed on this one?
Yeah, it's always good to remember PMs are kind of useless without collaboration. We're not worth a damn. So PM, if you're not really good at this, you're kind of...
We ain't going to get anything done.
You're in the wrong job. You're literally useless. But I think they're so I agree with what you're saying there. But I think the flavor of collaboration changes. I think the key point you mentioned is like, and we've made this mistake of like, hey, let's just throw everyone into the mix and let it work out. Assume it kind of works as it did before. For some projects, it's different. So basically, we actually wrote this up in January internally. Like what we recognize is there are some projects which have a high degree of uncertainty. Like in that technical side of, is this feasible? Is this doable? What is the right way to get to here? And in this early, like almost you could call it, it's like proving out the value of this. Is there core product value here, the core product proposition? And what we found is in that for like high profile projects or high uncertainty, high impact projects, it's like those actually need to be driven by ML because you cannot pull apart the product and technology. You can't. They are so tightly connected. And this is different. This is different to most technology, like SaaS technology, where, no, you can kind of pull these apart and then add the technology. Most of the time, that's true. But with early, particularly with AI generally, you can't. The product and the tech are like so tightly intertwined. And so we found for some of these projects, actually, the ML engineer needs to drive this because they need to have that super tight loop, pulling a team. And then it's like, okay, we think there's a thing here. Now let's actually productize this. And then you can go to a more normal setup like previously. So I think what you said is critical is like, if you just skip over this and assume everything will work out, it will likely bite you in the ass. And we've been bit in the ass by not being deliberate enough here. So it's like, you got to be deliberate. It's worth being deliberate. freaking Dassey, the most like awful sounding thing. Like, no, don't. Just like, they help. Everyone needs to know their role. Everyone needs to know who's an approver on stuff. And then it's easier to work. Ambiguity creates friction in that role stuff. So yeah, that's been an unexpected lesson for us of how deliberate we need to be. So yeah, it's funny. It's some of these things you relearn the same lessons, but there's just different flavors. Okay, so we'll wrap up with an impossible question, which is, you know, just tell me what the future of product management is for AI.
Oh dear, that is a big question. I guess this is interesting. I think in the blog post, I sort of mentioned that I didn't really think the whole, like, you know, is AI product management a thing? I think that was like one of the reflections that I sort of left it on. And I think it's an interesting discussion as we sort of figure out the space. But I think that in the future, AI will just be part of what we do, you know? And I think having said that, I think, you know, the new advancements in AI fundamentally change how we work as PMs, whether that's how we do the work or what work we do. You know, in terms of how we do the work, I think AI brings efficiency, right? It transforms the way that we search for information or generate content. I've had so many conversations with my peers lately in terms of how much they use AI to help them do their jobs. You know, some use it to make research more efficient, or, you know, generating an outline for an interview, or it's extracting insights from calls. Others will need it to do, you know, PRD outlines, or come up with ideas for solutions or GTM materials. I personally don't think it's at a stage where it's to, you know, completely automate these tasks for us, but it definitely goes a long way in helping you get a good start on whatever you're looking to do. And then in terms of, you know, what work we're actually doing, I believe, you know, the exercise of asking ourselves that we talked about before, whether AI can solve a problem or make a product 100 times better, is already a testament to the ambition and potential that this technology holds. We were talking about this before, you know, AI, ML, NLP, they aren't new technologies, but I think generative AI has made things so much more tangible to those who weren't necessarily immersed in that space before. You know, we talked about how using these new technologies just make it click for us. So I think that's something that is, you know, will become more of a commonplace, I think. And it just, you know, refers back to that first question around curiosity, right? Like understanding how it works, all of that kind of, you know, reflections that we do fundamentally change the way that we build and use products. And I think it makes us, you know, PMs not just more clued up in regards of like the art of the possible, but also in terms of how ambitious we can be as PMs as well. And I think that is, you know, regardless of the industry that we're in or the maturity of the product that we're working on, I think sort of a forcing function for us to think big. I know we talked about that in our session recently as well. You know, it fills our minds with what ifs, and I guess like if nothing else, that already makes things more exciting and creative for product managers in general. I don't know. I'm positive. I don't know. How about you? Maybe you've got completely wild different.
No, I don't have good thoughts here, because I think your phrase, the art of the possible, resonates a lot of like, because that's, we still don't know right now if the tech never improved. There's so much of the art of the possible that we haven't yet even thought about. And you know, some PMs are using it day in, day out, change a lot of their daily workflows, and some folks less so. But this is all the small changes, right? And then it will be like, as you mentioned, how you do the job, what is the product? Both of those can have the carpet pulled out from under them, or dramatic changes. And those might be next month, or those might be next year. So as PMs, you have to work in where, hey, we're trying to bring people to the product we've developed now, as well as develop the product of tomorrow, as well as recognizing that there's possibilities of leaps in technology on par with what we saw a year and a half ago that could happen any month, or maybe next year, or maybe 3 years. And so this, I think that art of the possible is like the I think the people who are thrive, who are most open to like everything changing, what I'm good at, what I'm where I felt confident, where I'm not, what I need to learn. It's like all the rules are being changed and rewritten as we speak. And before we finish writing those, they'll be changing again. So the pace of change for sure is like unprecedented, even in tech where it moves fast. So I think that art of the possible is like those who truly embrace the art of the possible, recognizing that what is possible is constantly is so fluid. That is the mindset to have it, because it's fun, exciting. All right. We'll stop there, Julia. That was pretty fun. Thanks for sharing all your thoughts.
Thank you. Yeah, thanks for the chat. I really enjoyed it. Let's do it again.
A huge thank you to Julia Godino for sharing her invaluable insights and experiences with AI product management, and to Brian Dunhu for guiding today's conversation. Don't miss out on future episodes by following us wherever you're listening to us now. And remember to sign up for the Intercom on Product newsletter for monthly insights into all things product management. All the links mentioned are in the show notes. That's it for this month on Intercom on Product. In the meantime, we have some great customer support discussions over on The Ticket, or sister podcast. So don't miss that. Thanks for listening.